for thousands of people in Jacksonville, a decent and affordable place to live is just a dream. This morning, we continue our Chasing the Dream series as a local landlord has his say. Good Tuesday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We're always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show now, too, with our partner, TVJax.com. Just ahead, we'll take your calls on Chasing the Dream, a look at the challenges around finding affordable housing on the First Coast. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, have you ever thought about running for office? The new runforoffice.org could help you, plus the Britt Rose Foundation. All of that ahead. But first this hour, the deplorable conditions at the local low-income housing project Eureka Gardens captured national headlines when it came to light that residents were living with dangerous mold, leaky gas pipes, and other big problems. For poor people in Jacksonville, finding housing that's both affordable and livable can be hard to come by. Finding shelter often means settling for dangerously run-down apartments and dealing with the constant threat of eviction. Now, we've been focusing all this month on how tough it is to find affordable housing in our area in WJCT's Chasing the Dream series. Later in the hour, we'll talk to a local landlord about this. Examining what housing is available when you're poor and what's being done to help against a public housing system that's underfunded nationwide has been our goal. Now, sometimes people qualify for public housing, but for whatever reason, they choose not to take advantage of it. WJCT's Jessica Palumbo introduces us to one family trying to make it work on the city's north side.
It's either move or stay.
Annette Nathan is considering leaving the four-bedroom house in northwest Jacksonville she rents with her five kids and granddaughter.
And I do not receive public assistance at all. I'm a worker. Everything that I do come out my pocket. So I do deserve to live someplace decent.
But a livable home has been hard to find. She's on her third house in this area after major issues and unresponsive landlords.
Ceiling collapsing, roof need repairing, water coming in when the rain fall. That's house number two. And now this one has been the worst.
With a broken AC unit, the air inside is hot and muggy. After a pipe burst 5 months ago, water seeped into the wall of her granddaughter's bedroom closet for months.
So all in here was wet, molded. And gnats and stuff was in there, maggots.
Moldy carpet and padding is torn up on top of yet-to-be-repaired floorboards. The situation is worse in the bathroom and kitchen.
That is one of the cabinets over there that should have been repaired. They forgot about that and left it.
Leaks are still attracting mold and bugs. Nathan says it's all taking a toll on her granddaughter, Amari.
She's 2 years old. She didn't have asthma when she was born. She didn't have asthma until she moved here. And I have taken her to the emergency room, me and her mom, take her to the doctor. And now she's taking inhalers and wearing a mask. And at daycare, she's coughing and wheezing.
Nathan has withheld rent. But instead of fixing the problems right away, her landlord kept sending eviction notices. Legal aid attorney Jeff Haney got involved to help fight for the family's rights. He says the situation is typical among his clients.
I wouldn't know that Jacksonville was two different worlds if I didn't work here, probably, you know, and see this stuff all the time. But I think a lot of people just don't know so much of the city is in such bad shape. And so for so long, the owners of these properties, for example, there's just no light shining on them. So why would they do anything different?
Since Haney got involved, Nathan says repairs are coming very slowly. In the meantime, she's on the lookout for a better place. But with her $11.25 an hour income, her options are scarce, she says.
This area is full of crime. Believe me, they have gun shooting all the time. Police here, police there. It's not safe to be in. I'm not looking to just jump up and move to another bad house. So this is where I live at.
She says her daughter, Amari's mom, is trying to get out by signing up for public housing. She's one of 16,000 area residents on the waiting list. Jessica Palumbo, 89.9 WJCT News.
Now, for several weeks now, we've been talking to tenants when it comes to this issue of affordable housing in Jacksonville. This morning, another perspective. George Eckenrode runs White Collar Management. He's a landlord for Section 8 voucher and other low-income tenants on Jacksonville's north side. And he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
And when it comes to chasing the dream, the often challenging quest for affordable housing for low-income people in our area, what are your questions? What are your comments? Give us a call with your thoughts at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect and email and tweet us. So you decided to weigh in on this after hearing some of our reports. You've been a landlord on the north side for some time. How did you get involved in that?
We got involved with this, my wife and I, about 18 years ago, about 2 years after we moved to Jacksonville. And we got originally involved. We put corporate housing together, furnished short-term housing. And a little bit after that, 2 years into that project, we started getting some ideas of buying bank-owned cheap houses, very cheap. And the reality was is that the formula for us was that if we could buy the house and renovate it, and when I'm talking renovate it, that's new windows, kitchens with all wood, not fiberboard kitchens, new flooring, either tile or recondition the hardwood floors, which a lot of the Jacksonville homes have hardwood floors, sound roofs, sometimes replacing the roofs. And if we could get in and out under $45,000, then that would actually be a profitable venture for us to both rent or flip.
Mm-hmm. And after 18 years of doing this, yes, you've discovered that it's not as easy as it looks. What are some of the biggest issues and challenges you faced as a landlord?
As a landlord, the biggest problem is getting too friendly or emotionally involved with the tenants. So some of mine are Section 8 and voucher, and that's paid directly by the city, but the others are month to month. And so generally when you show up, you'll hear a story.
And we want your calls as we talk about Section 8 housing and low-income housing in Jacksonville. Give us a call, 549-2937. As you told us when we started looking at this issue, you've realized that it's difficult to find tenants on the north side that can even get into the housing you're trying to put together. Is that right?
It's somewhat difficult to get in. Our rents are very low. A 2 and a 3 bedroom home rents about $650, which I think is very affordable. Mm-hmm. And the Section 8 program was closed for a number of years, so people couldn't get on the rolls to get in it. Once you're in it, you generally try to stay in it because it's the easy way to stay in a home.
When you look at a rent of $650 for a 2-bedroom house, that seems like a really easy rent for most people to make. But that for a middle-class family, that's an easy rent. For a low-income family, even that can be too much, right?
I would agree.
Yeah. So what are some of the problems that you say you don't want to get too close to the tenants or too friendly with them? What are some of the problems you've had over the years with tenants?
Some of the problems we've had would be that they'll just get so far behind in the rent that they owe us that in reality, when they get, even if it's a half payment per month, when it gets around the third month, it's almost going to be impossible to catch back up. Mm-hmm. So then it becomes a real issue. Do I want to go to eviction, which is costly even for the landlord? It's horrible for the person in the home, the tenant, because it's a mark on the record, and then they cannot rent another home easily because it's easy to find out if somebody has an eviction on the record.
You've called this almost a hamster wheel.
Correct. I refer to it a hamster wheel because the people that are in it, I was referring to that on the Section 8 piece because there's generations of people that stay in that because it is so, I don't want to say easy, but simple to maintain a life with a home, a roof over your head. And if you screw up in a Section 8 home, either through non-payment or some problem that would be investigated and you get thrown out of it, you cannot get back in.
You can't get back in. And when they hold queues for Section 8 housing, they've done them right outside WJCT here near the football stadium.
Mm-hmm.
Thousands of people show up.
Oh, I'll bet there's a lot more people.
Yeah, right? Thousands of people are trying to get into the program.
Correct.
And, you know, when in your capacity as a landlord, you've dealt with the Section 8 program for a long time. So you have a perspective from trying to rent these properties. The Section 8 program has come under a lot of criticism, I think it's fair to say. So from your point of view, what do you think needs to be done to improve this program?
I'd say when it comes to improving the Section 8 program, I think the biggest problem that I run into as a landlord is, let's take for example, a family living in it has a complete voucher and the city is making the $650 payment. If the person, the head of household, gets employed, the city will start to reduce the amount that they'll pay to me directly, and they will then tell the head of household that you will owe the landlord X amount of money. And if the job gets better and better, that amount gets larger to me. And whereby that looks good on paper, like we're rehabbing the tenants and giving them a shot at life and employment, unfortunately, mm-hmm. what happens is we get back into that problem where I'll hear a story as to where the money is for me on the month.
And let's go to your calls right now. It's our Chasing the Dream series this morning. As we look at the issues around affordable housing on the First Coast, so many working poor people or just poor people who can't afford housing. We've talked to tenants, and this morning we're talking to a landlord. What are your questions about this? What have been your challenges in finding affordable rent? Give us a call, 549-2937. Tim is in Yulee. Hi, Tim. How are you?
Good, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call. And I think you might have already answered my question, but just a real quick story and then a question. My mother passed about 2 years ago, and she left me with a couple of homes in another state. And one of the homes was occupied by a Section 8 tenant. So once, you know, I became executive of the state, you know, I decided that I wanted to not become a landlord, and I decided to sell the property. But there was a lot of things wrong with the home, and, you know, I wasn't real versed and knowledgeable of Section 8. So when I decided to evict her, there was a lot of issues with Section 8 about giving her the security deposit back, and actually I read up on it and realized that I couldn't keep it. But I had a lot of issues with the housing authority to the point that, you know, they actually told me that if I didn't give her the security deposit back, that I wouldn't be able to rent in Section 8, which I was fine with that. But apparently she had lived in the home that my mother had for 11 years. And so my question is, and I know there are some people that genuinely need Section 8, but wouldn't you consider it a trap? Because is there an end game to Section 8? Like, if this woman was in there for 11 years, isn't there like some program to say, hey, let's look at your credit, let's see if we can get you off of Section 8 and into buying you a home instead of some of these people in generations staying on Section 8 for years? And like I said, I know there's some people that genuinely need it, but there are some people that really should not be on Section 8, and they actually should be in programs to actually get them to a point that they can actually buy a home. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Tim. George.
Interesting you should say get them into buying a home. Earlier, just before this program started, I was talking to Melissa. Our original plan when we went into this, we had three homes on the north side that we completely renovated. They were beautiful. They were like model homes. My wife and I spent 2 months doing open houses on the weekends, and everyone that came in was very impressed with the homes. But their question was, how much was it? And then we were selling the homes for $50,000, which was a very small profit to us and easy to get into. The city was giving $5,000 free money for down payments, and mortgage rates were low. So anybody could get in and start to own a home, own an actual home, and the payments would probably be about $450 a month. The thing that everyone asked us was, how much would you rent this home to us, and do you take a voucher? So I made up a number. I said, I'll rent it for $900, and we're talking about a three-bedroom house or a two-bedroom, which was way over what I wanted to. And they said, well, that sounds great. Where's the application? So they preferred, because of this kind of trap, as the last caller called it, because it was easier to stay in a Section 8 program than to actually take ownership and responsibility for the home.
And that you see is the central problem.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And let's go to some more of your calls as we speak with our landlord about Section 8 and low-income housing in Jacksonville. Part of our Chasing the Dream series, affordable housing is just a dream for many Americans, and there are a lot of layers to this discussion. We want your calls, 549-2937. What's been your experience? What are your thoughts? Let's go to Johnny in Washington Heights. Hi, Johnny.
Hi, Melissa. Long time I haven't called in a long time.
Oh, well, thanks for calling.
And it seems like the theme of what I have to say is going to be when I used to call. Tim, the caller from Yulee, and this is just so indicative of the situation where he says, like, someone left me a house and left me a couple of houses. I rented them out. And what we're talking about is access to the market. Like, a lot of these people don't have access to the market, and it's so historical. You know, it was at one time when we're talking post-World War II when the mortgages and the loans were steered away from the black people and or just the low-income people on the north side. And that's pretty much what we're talking about. And it's so much history. And when they talked about the hamster wheel is going round and round, I think it's been going around so long that Section 8 just can't fix the problem.
Yeah.
And that's it. True.
Okay. Yeah, that's Johnny in Washington Heights. Thanks for the call. Calls from all over the listening area at 549-2937. Let's go to Michael in Palatka. Hi, Michael.
How are you?
Doing well, thanks. Thanks for calling.
Listen, I just, you know, I'm listening to this program. You know, I'm an African-American. Actually, I'm an immigrant from Jamaica. Uh-huh. And I just don't think Section 8 is a solution for any of this problem. Both your last callers, and the caller before, made a great point. The one thing these people, and I say these people, including myself, who's looking for housing, whatever, responsibility. People that stay on Section 8, they don't want the responsibility of having to own a home and do all the stuff that's required. They don't want that. So why should the city waste my money as a taxpayer to help these people to get homes? It should be a program that, you know, if you're on the program, and yes, I sound passionate because I'm very angry because I need help and I can't get it. If I lose my job, I can't even get help. And there are people out here living on the system, getting free food and free housing and free. Why should they try to do anything different?
All right, that's Michael in Palatka.
Michael, I
agree. George?
I agree, Michael, that you're hitting it the nail right on the head when you said many do not want to accept the responsibility of owning a home. And that is exactly what I found out, because people that rent, and this is even beyond the Section 8 people that rent feel that, oh, if the garbage disposal breaks, the landlord's got to come in here and fix it.
What would you say, though, to programs like Habitat for Humanity? They've helped, you know, millions of Americans, or hundreds of thousands at least, get into housing. They make a potential homeowner put what they call sweat equity into the home. They have to help in the construction of the home. They get them into homes that they with a monthly payment, mortgage payment that they can afford. I mean, there are Americans that want to get into affordable housing and own it.
Definitely. I think that's an excellent program, and good for bringing that one up. That's a total success, the Habitat program. Mm-hmm.
So in your view, as you've done this for almost 20 years now, and we're not making a lot of progress in Jacksonville when it comes to poverty and affordable housing. It's a big quality of life issue in this city. What are your final thoughts about what you think should be done to improve the system?
I'd have to say I don't want to come up with ideas on how to fix the Section 8 program, because I feel it has a lot of good to it, too. So I have no ideas on how to repair that. But earlier I mentioned to you, and I definitely like this get out to the radio audience, I think our mayor who has a program to eliminate blight here in the city. I think he's on board with that. Any blight can be termed abandoned houses or just plenty of the houses on the north side. I get very passionate, as Michael was passionate before, that the problem with that is that for a real estate investor and a possible landlord, ending up with one of those houses has a very, very high hidden price tag of all the non-paid property taxes that the city jams on us as investors. I mentioned I bought a house for $9,000, did a title search on it, came up clean. I was about 2 weeks into renovation when the city slapped a piece on my door saying that I owed $65,000 for a fine. And the fine was a renter a number of years ago put a washing machine on their back porch, hung the drain pipe out the window. City found out about it, started the fine. The owner at that point left the house. Taxes started to accumulate. I bought the house cheap for $9,000, but I had to negotiate for months with the city, got it down to $15,000, that fine, and had to pay it. I think the city needs to reevaluate their ideas of getting rid of, instead of bulldozing down a number of houses. There's a number of investors and people, or even Habitat Humanity, taking on existing houses and doing rehab. There's plenty of people that would love to get those houses, but city does not make them affordable.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Very welcome. Thank you.
George Eckenrode runs White Collar Management, and he's a landlord with Section 8 and low-income property on the city's north side. And much more still ahead later. Learn about Jacksonville's Britt Rose Foundation. But up next, the new website helping anyone that wants to run for office. That's next.
Funding for Chasing the Dream is provided by the JPB Foundation and the Ford Foundation.
Who is your American graduate champion? WJCT is looking to recognize and honor a wide range of community leaders and everyday heroes who regularly dedicate their time, talent, and resources to prepare students for success and graduation. American graduate champions are role models in their communities whose stories have the potential to inspire others to take action. The nomination deadline is July 15th at 5 p.m. Click the button on WJCT.org to nominate your American graduate champion today.
We've heard a lot about Wall Street during this election, but how is Main Street doing?
Everyone says that small business is the engine of our economy. But right now, the engine needs gas. We need fuel.
I'm Molly Wood. The economy could use a little pedal to the metal. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Hello, I'm Mayor Lenny Curry. It's hurricane season. Are you Jacks ready? Learn more about how you can keep yourselves and your family safe during a storm. Download the 2016-2017 City of Jacksonville Preparedness Guide today at jacksready.com and tune in to 89.9, the area's official emergency broadcast station.
On the next Fresh Air, Robert F. Kennedy's transformation from stalwart anti-communist to liberal icon. We talk with journalist Larry Tai about his new biography of Kennedy, which includes new insights on the early part of his career when he worked for Senator Joseph McCarthy. The Kennedy family gave Tai access to private family papers. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, it can be a challenge both locally and nationwide if you're an interested political candidate. There are a lot of things to look at: finding an open position, qualifying deadlines, and the requirements for elections. That may be why only 2% of Americans ever run for office, and 40% of state legislature races in the U.S. go uncontested. So to make the process more accessible, a newly launched online platform called runforoffice.org is now available here in Duval County. RunForOffice.org is a free website, and it gives people from any background the tools they need to become an elected official. Online, you'll find a fully searchable database, a list of every elected office in the area, filing requirements, even training, a free class. Run for Office's spokesman Jim Couples is on the line to tell us more. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. And thanks for being with us. So how did Run for Office come to life? How did this get started?
Exactly as you were explaining in the beginning, I was interested in running for a position and could not find anywhere online information on where I would apply or where I would file the papers, what the filing window was. By the time I had put that information together, the filing window had passed. And I just thought it was crazy that you could enter your address and see, you know, wherever you want to eat Italian food or Chinese food or all these other things you could do that was address searchable, but not information on how you could become involved as a candidate.
Yeah, and there's so much more to it, even for local office, than people realize. It can be kind of a Byzantine maze to kind of navigate your way through everything you have to do.
Yeah, so, you know, very often that procedure goes something like people that already know people that are in office or people that work with the major county parties, they sometimes get more information than the average citizen, and they get a little bit more hand-holding between what to apply for and how to begin that political process. So The thought is that information should be more widely available. You know, we should all be like that mayor's niece who gets onto the school board without any competition and then begins her political career, or the nephew, of some county commissioner who guides him to a soil and water conservation district where that's really important in the community and leading in their political career. For people that don't have friends in those spots, it can be very daunting. It's unfamiliar to most people. I think often of the single parent who wants to get involved with their kid's school board. If you don't know anyone or how to get involved in that process, there's usually nothing on their websites, and so it can be a little bit discouraging if you have zero information to go from.
Right, and if you're not part of, you know, the insider network, it can be difficult. So you're trying to bring all of these tools and the insider knowledge to every man. On this website, runforoffice.org, you can access a free voter file with all the voters in your district. There's more information in this database. But the other thing that you offer is a free course, How to Run for Office. What's part of this free course?
Sure. So Run for Office is a product of Nation Builder, and that's the company I work for. And Run for Office is just a project that we're doing. So inside Nation Builder, we have a lot of people with experience in political campaigns, and political campaigns on the local level all the way up to presidential campaigns. We were doing this runforoffice.org project, and the thought was, hey, how can we take this a step further and kind of pool our knowledge together so that people running their first race can understand what to do? So we did that. It took a couple of months. A bunch of us put our heads together, and we started with the courses offer things on how to establish a timeline for events that you want to hold, or understanding the target amount of votes that you're going to have to get to win this race. Things like that are all baked into a pretty amazing online course. I'm really proud of that. And the work that some of my friends at Nation Builder did for that. So thanks for mentioning that. It's something, if anyone's interested in running, check out those courses. They're free, and I think they give a really good background, especially if you're running your first campaign. But even if you've run a whole bunch already, everyone that's participated in that have been around the block a couple of times. So it's good information.
All right, let's go to your calls right now about runforoffice.org. A free way to learn more about running for office. What are your questions? Have you ever thought about running for office yourself? 549-2937. Mitchell in Palatka. Hi, Mitchell. How are you?
Just fine. I've run for mayor of Atlanta on a couple occasions and governor of Georgia, and right now I'm a write-in candidate for president of the United States.
Okay.
I'm registered in 22 states already, but I find that
What's your last name? What's your last name?
Mitchell Williams.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
And the problem is this, that there's so much variation on the way some states require write-in candidates to register, and there are a few states that flatly refuse to allow you to vote. They apparently have no place on the ballot to do it, and I'm having to sue those states to force them to do that. The weirdest one that I've run into to date is the Secretary of State of Utah requires the candidate to come walking into their office to register. You could send a representative to do it, but you have to walk into their office. It's like, you know, demanding that they climb into their office on their knees as you walk up the steps. But it's all very interesting and it's fun. So far I've spent about $400 on the race and I will get votes this year.
All right.
Well, and that's what's satisfying to me.
All right. Thanks, Mitchell. And, you know, as he pointed out, Jim, anyone can run for office, but usually not just anyone wins. Your aim, I think, is to level the playing field somewhat.
Yeah, that's exactly it regarding leveling the playing field. And Mitch brings up a really good point in that the process of how to run for office can vary wildly within a state, within the county, even within the city. Sometimes there will be two different filing windows for different positions.
Mm-hmm.
So he's 100% spot on regarding the fragmented nature of the process to get on the ballot. I'd like to add one other thing regarding how this project got to Duval County. There was simply a local volunteer there who contacted me and said, hey, it would be helpful if we had this here in Duval County. And we had mostly done some other bigger counties with a couple million percentage of people in the population. So Duval is a little bit smaller, but being that there was a grassroots interest in wanting to have that information more accessible, that's why we did it. It's different everywhere, and that's one of the reasons that we depend so much on volunteers helping us source this information, just like Mitch is saying. And he's talking about the presidential race. When you get down to the hundreds of thousands of local offices, it gets wonkier and wonkier as far as that procedure. So, he's correct in that it's difficult and inconsistent regarding how we appear on the ballot.
Here's a tweet from Ben. The voter files are public, but you need a platform to make sense of them, and those can be costly. This will help level the playing field. Now, on your website, runforoffice.org, you mentioned some 40% of state legislature races in this country go uncontested, no opposition at all. Do you attribute that to gerrymandering, just districts that aren't competitive?
No, I do not attribute it to that at all. I think there would be plenty of people that would be happy to run these races. I feel that the major parties especially do a really poor job developing their bench with younger candidates. When you're in a district and, you've been clobbered there a bunch of times by the other team, they usually just roll over and they won't put anyone out there due to the expense of helping someone with the campaign. It's a really poor symptom when you have that many uncontested races for such important positions in the state legislature. At Nation Builder, we recognized this in 2014 and how few races there are out there. So all of this stuff, what we were seeing was kind of coming together. And when you see so many different political efforts out there, and we've certainly seen them this year, those people want to run, right? It's the accessibility to that information and kind of being able to game plan around it and understand that a year from now I'm going to want to launch my campaign, I'm going to want to have this much money set aside. So no, gerrymandering is not it at all. Mm-hmm. A lot of this lays on the major and minor parties. They do not do a good job with their volunteers. They want them to knock on doors, but they don't want them to run for office. And I lay that blame very far and very wide.
Okay, so that's helpful to know. Do you also think that average people are dissuaded from running for office? The old trope is that the most qualified people hardly ever seek the office. The best people are turned off from running for office. They see the issues around fundraising and people digging into their background as just being, you know, seedy. They don't want to go there. How much do you think that's a factor?
I don't think that's as much of a factor as people would like to believe. We hear about those stories, but if you were to compare how often you hear those stories with the vast amount of locally elected positions, it's a real small percentage regarding, like, you know, someone's background coming up or the real vitriolic stuff. I don't think that it's because it's become a little bit more aggressive that's what's keeping people from running for office. I really feel that it's a matter of organization and having this information available, as well as address searchable, since so much is address dependent on what you can run for.
Now that this website is up, and by the way, this is accessible for people in Duval County, what's the response been from people that are interested in getting more involved in the political process now that they have this information at hand?
It's been really encouraging. It's been encouraging because I'll very often get emails and people will say, thanks for doing this. But I don't think we're really going to see the effects from this platform for about another cycle or so, because people have to actually organize around it. So the filing window for Florida just closed a couple of weeks ago. And as far as I know, I don't think there's that big of an uptick in Duval County for candidates and some of those positions. But I don't expect something instantly to happen like that. What I really want to see happen is I want to see people that are concerned about the schools in their community recognizing that this tool is out there, and that this cycle, you know, when you first see it, it might be a little bit too soon, but perhaps next cycle they'll be running for their school boards or their city council positions. That's what I'm hoping to happen.
Okay, well, we'll continue to follow it. Thanks for sharing it with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for the interest, and thanks for the Duval County resident who volunteered to put this information together.
Jim Couples is with the new free online platform, runforoffice.org. And we'll be back in a moment.
America's middle class has always been a moving target. Flint, Michigan was once a boom town.
All is excitement. Even the small fry are buzzing.
Today, vacant houses are being torn down.
Our old school is closed and abandoned.
The New Middle, exploring what it means to be middle class in America today, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross.
Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Jesse Seren's adult life is on hold.
Who could afford a wedding? Who could afford a house? Who could afford a child?
Because she has $90,000 in student loans. But while loans are holding back some grads, people who made those loans are getting rich.
Like, wow, you know, here's people making a lot of money off of this.
Find out who next time on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT and Baptist Health invite you to Girls Day Out, Saturday, September 17th at the Hyatt Hotel. Enjoy breakfast, lunch, great speakers, including celebrity chef My Fam, and Good Morning America host and breast cancer survivor Amy Robach. Tickets are $40. Log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, 1 in 5 people in this country suffer from a diagnosable and treatable mental illness, but nearly 2/3 of them get little to no help. Tori Serpa decided to do something about that. She's the founder and owner of the Britt Rose Foundation. It's a local nonprofit focused on suicide prevention, mental illness, and bullying. And she started it following the suicide of her own daughter, who had bipolar disorder. Tori Serpa, good morning, and thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And you've tried to turn a tragic family story into helping others, which is so commendable. Can you tell us a little bit about your daughter, Brittany Rose?
Brittany was the most outgoing, bubbly young girl that you would ever meet. She was beautiful. She was a cheerleader. She was, she wasn't the typical girl that you would think would be being bullied. She wasn't, the strange kid sitting in the cafeteria. She wasn't, she was just popular, and she was really the kid at school that was always rallying for the kids who were being bullied.
Right.
So it was really kind of odd that she would end up being a bully victim herself.
When she was 12, you started to notice some changes in Brittany's behavior.
When she was 12, which was a really young age, she really wasn't going through adolescence yet. We just noticed it was like a light switch went off. And we were on a family vacation, and it literally was like a light switch. And we're like, gosh, she's just doing things that weren't age appropriate for her age. I call them high risk behaviors, and I don't mean like sexually or anything that way. I mean just high risk behaviors, things that a 12-year-old wouldn't be doing. And it just struck us as odd. I'm like, what in the world would make you think to do that?
Yeah. And so you began this long odyssey of figuring out what was going on with her.
We began an 8-year process of trying to find out what struck us as odd behavior. We literally went from one doctor to another, from one side of the United States to the other. We were the lucky family that means were not a problem in our case. We were able to figure out who was the best doctor in the country, and we literally got on a plane and went there. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't give us an answer. And it was an ongoing journey for about 8 years.
Man. Eventually, though, you did get a diagnosis.
Eventually, we did get a diagnosis. Several doctors gave us diagnoses along the way that really didn't really apply to her. And eventually, we did get a diagnosis that she was bipolar with rapid cycling, which is kind of the worst bipolar that you can have.
Uh-huh.
And it really gave us, it almost gave us some peace that we got that diagnosis, because it started giving us some answers as to where the strange behavior was coming from. And it gave us a peace of mind that we now had, we had a name for this behavior, and we have, and bipolar is treatable, you know, whether it's bipolar or depression or anxiety. This is a treatable illness. So we actually were sort of excited when we got the diagnosis, because it started giving us some answers.
Because, and now you could treat Brittany.
And now we could treat her.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is treatable.
And so unfortunately, your happiness was short-lived, because she went away to college, Ole Miss. What happened then?
Well, she actually didn't make it to Ole Miss.
Oh, she never got there.
She never got there. April 5th of 2012, we were filling out sorority rush packets and picking out roommates and decorating her dorm, and she was ready to go off to Ole Miss. And she was involved with an online bullying situation on Facebook. It was all private messaging. It wasn't anything that was publicized. Like a lot of people have incidents where it's broadcast on Twitter or whatever. This was actually private messaging from a girl who was a complete stranger. But because Brittany had bipolar, she was super fragile, and things that would, bullying is awful in any realm. In her particular case, because she had bipolar, she was super, super, a super fragile person.
So trolling or insulting comments that another kid might brush off, she took those to heart.
Yeah. I mean, especially that this was a complete stranger. I mean, she didn't know this girl. It was over a boy. It was just girl just reached out to her out of the blue and just said all this ugly, hateful stuff. And you know, my daughter had never experienced bullying before. This was something really foreign to her. And so she was trying to convince this girl that, you know, she was wrong and she had some bad information and none of the stuff she was telling her was true. And this happened on a Monday.
Yeah.
And by Thursday, she was gone. It happened that fast. This wasn't an ongoing thing that happened for years. And yeah, but because she was suffering with anxiety and depression and bipolar, and wasn't being treated for it. We had just found out about the bipolar treatment, and she was not yet on medication.
Yeah.
It just blindsided us.
Yeah, absolutely. So heartbreaking. And these issues around people in this country having such a difficult time getting access to treatment when it comes to their mental health, and also this issue of cyberbullying. In your daughter's case, they were certainly linked. And in the years since she died, what you've done is so extraordinary. You've started a foundation named after your daughter. Can you tell us about it?
Well, when the suicide happened, I was the one that found her. And I had two choices. One was to curl up in a ball and never get out of bed. And one was to go out and make sure that our story didn't become the story for another family. And so, I mean, it was right out of the gate. It wasn't a year later. It wasn't 4 years later. It was, we went into full gear, I went into mama mode gear, mama beer gear. Yeah. And we just wanted to make sure that this didn't happen to another family. And even though I'm only one person, the more people that I can reach to share Brittany's story, that when somebody's struggling, that they have to reach out for help. And that if we can reduce the stigma, this is what the foundation was set up to do, so that we can start talking about it, so that we reduce the stigma, so that people aren't ashamed to talk about it. Mm-hmm. That we've all suffered with bouts of anxiety or depression. Every one of us, I don't think one of us could say, I never went through a time where I was feeling sad or feeling anxious about something. But why do we not talk about it? We don't talk about it because our society has sort of put a stigma on it that, mm-hmm. you know, it's a mental illness. But really the reality is it's a brain disease, just like any other organ in your body. Just like if you were to have cancer or prostate problems or breast cancer. So we started the foundation so that people can start talking about it. Mm-hmm. And that we start talking about it like we talk about any other disease. And that if we can reduce the stigma and start talking about it, that people will actually start to reach out for help.
Yeah, and you want to make that easy for people. And you've done it with this great portal that I think will attract so many folks. Can you tell us about the portal you set up online?
Well, we wanted, I didn't want to continue to talk about the sadness. I wanted to be able to reach people in a fun and engaging way without continuing to talk about my sad story. And I am quite the shopper, and Brittany was quite the shopper. And so we started an online women's boutique, clothing boutique, and our target market was college girls and their moms, because that's who I was at the time. I had a daughter getting ready to go to college, and I was a mom. So we kind of target that market, and it's a 501c, uh-huh. And it's called it's www.brittrose.com. It's shopbrittrose.com, uh-huh. And all of the sales, 100% of the sales go to organizations that help in the area of mental illness and bullying and reducing the stigma of mental illness.
And it's a great website, by the way.
Yeah.
There's some really cute stuff on this website. A new spring and summer collection is on shopbrittrose.com. There's resort wear, all kinds of stuff, jewelry. It's really nice. And all proceeds go toward, as you said, organizations working on this issue, like NAMI, the National Association for Mental Illness, AASP, the Association for Suicide Prevention, and others. What a wonderful way to support them.
Yes.
And it's this is something that's close to my heart as well. So it's really a pleasure to be with you and share this with the community. Again, that website is shopbritrose.com. If you add that to your bookmarks and shop there, buy a gift there, all the proceeds go toward reducing the stigma around mental illness in this country. Tori Serpa, the founder and owner of the Britt Rose Foundation, with us. And thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to the Daily Podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And video segments always up every week at our partners, TVJax.com and MetroJacksonville.com. Next on Diane Rehm, Congress has only 8 more days in session before senators and representatives take their August recess. The political party conventions begin in mid-July. An update on what's happening in Congress and the presidential campaigns. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.